Welcome to the 2024, Volume 6, Issue 1, Part 2, Summer Podcast Edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published February 21, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Dedicated to the memory of Joseph Schieber 1970 to 2024. Table of Contents. Book Symposium. Guest Editor. Michael Deckard, Lenoir Rhin University. Article 5. Pasco, Josephine and Miguel Segundo Orton. 2024. The Role of Narrative Practices in Embodied and Effective Change. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 6, Number 1, pages 29 to 36. https://doedit.org/10334972024summer-4. Article 6. Schieber Joseph. 2024. Heteronomy, Repression, and Collective Wisdom. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 6, Number 1, pages 37 to 43. https://doedit.org/10334972024summer.5. Article 7. Temuri Ali. 2024. The Mind and the Political. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 6, Number 1, pages 44 to 50. https://doedit.org/10334972024summer.6. Article 8. Wilson Lee. 2024. Embodied Cognition in Dark Times. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 6, Number 1, pages 51 to 58. https://doedit.org/10334972024summer.7. Article 5. The Role of Narrative Practices in Embodied and Effective Change. By Josephine Pasco and Miguel Segundo Orton. In a nutshell, The Mind-Body Politic, Mays and Hanna 2019, can be unpacked in three main theses. 1. Social institutions shape and transform our embodied minds. 2. Neoliberal institutions shape our embodied minds in detrimental and harmful ways. And 3. We can revert these harmful influences, creating social institutions that instead promote mentally healthy, authentic, and fulfilling lives. Refer to Pasco 2021. In this brief commentary, we mostly focus on 1 and 3. Our main aim is to show that we can complement the proposal advanced by Mays and Hanna, hereafter M and H, to revert the harmful effects of neoliberal social institutions by understanding the role that narratives and narrative practices play in shaping our embodied minds. The structure of the commentary is as follows. In the first section, we examine the role that the authors give to narratives in the mind-body politic. After this, we introduce the notion of narrative practices, which is meant to highlight the productive aspect of narrativity. Finally, we conclude by suggesting that the notion of narrative practices can be a useful addition to M. and H.'s proposal for building social institutions that promote mentally healthy, authentic, and fulfilling lives. Section 1. Narratives and Habits of Mind in the Mind-Body Politic. Essential to the proposal of the mind-body politic is the adoption of an inactive conception of cognition. This approach rejects the orthodox conception view, according to which cognitive abilities, perceiving, thinking, imagining, etc., consist of disembodied computational processes that occur in the brain alone. Contrarywise, it proposes that these cognitive abilities emerge from the complex and irreducible interaction of neural and bodily processes, and that they are structured by our biological and metabolic necessities. Hence, this conception rejects intellectualism about cognition and emphasizes the connection between mindedness and the living body, page 17. To this inactive proposal, they add the claim that our essentially embodied minds are partially determined and literally shaped by the social institutions we belong to, page 37, emphasis in the original. To fully understand this, it is important to note the role of affective framing. This is a spontaneous, non-inferential, and pre-reflective way of engaging and navigating the world by selecting and paying attention to those elements that are relevant to our current concerns and necessities. The animal, they explicate, makes sense of its surrounding through its effectively aroused body, page 42, emphasis in the original. Applying this idea to human beings, M. and H. claim that the social institutions we partake in exert normative constraints on our affective framing, partially determining our patterns of attention, behavior, and consciousness. This cultural shaping occurs fundamentally through the acquisition and refinement of habits. Such habits go from simple patterns of perception and action to more sophisticated schemas of interpretation, justification, and judgment. The so-called habits of mind, page 46. As a result, through learning and socialization, individuals come to internalize social and cultural norms that they enact regularly, often outside of their own awareness, page 52. It is in the habits of mind where narratives play an important role. According to M. and H., from a very young age, individuals are exposed to narrative archetypes. These are coherent stories about what actions are permitted and expected from particular types of persons, 199. Also refer to Brancaccio, 2019. As such, narrative archetypes encode social conventions and norms and serve to sculpt our habits of mind when they are learned and internalized. Examples of these narrative archetypes are those which are related to gender norms and those related to neoliberal, capitalist notions such as entrepreneurship, profit, and so on. M. and H. S. account highlights successfully how a great deal of our behaviors and thoughts are shaped by social entities that operate outside of our awareness, with mostly damaging results. However, the picture of agency that emerges from it is that of an individual whose embodied relation to the world is passively shaped, most of the time by external influences. For instance, M. and H. often highlight how people develop habits in accordance with values that they have not freely chosen, and are not even able to acknowledge other alternatives, pages 54 and 87. This is largely correct, in our view, but we also believe that a more optimist picture can be presented once we recognize the larger role that narrativity and narrative practices play in our capacity to adapt and negotiate our social and cultural environment, beyond the one played by narrative archetypes. What is not highlighted in their analysis are two important aspects of narrativity. One, its active, deliberative, and productive functions, and two, its strong entanglement with our embodiment. In the following, we will argue that the concept of narrative practices can be a useful addendum to M. and H.'s account, and will show how it can allow for agents to assume a more active role within social institutions by engaging in conscious and deliberative self-narration. Section 2. Narrative archetypes and narrative practices. Talk about narrativity in philosophy and psychology has mostly revolved around the recognition of the fact that both self-understanding and our understanding of others is often, although not exclusively, narrative. This means that we understand people, whether ourselves or others, and their actions, in terms of a diachronic, temporally ordered and mostly coherent web of beliefs, reasons, aims, and so on. Besides, the term narrative evokes the idea that we interpret ourselves and others as characters in a story, where every action can be made sense of only in terms of the coherent whole. In addition, it is a widespread claim that narrativity is at least partly constitutive of our self-identity, Brandon 2016, McKenzie 2009, 2014, Rudd 2012, 2016, Schechtman 1996, 2007, meaning that the way we narrate our lives and the resulting understanding we have of them partly determines who we are as persons, but refer to Hutto 2016 and Strawson 2004 for arguments against these views. In the following, however, we will discuss an aspect of narrativity that has attracted less attention in the literature. That is, the fact that self-narration can be a productive tool that allows agents to actively shape themselves and their behavior. In order to clarify how our analysis can be useful to M. and H. S. account, we will firstly elaborate on the phenomenon of narrative archetypes and their effect on our narrative framing. Our goal is to show why focusing solely on this phenomenon falls short. M. and H. take inspiration from Brancaccio, 2019, to understand narrative archetypes. Crucially, the analysis of Brancaccio focuses on the way agents regularly evaluate and explain their own actions, including past, present, and future, in terms of who they understand themselves to be as a person continuous in time. This, she argues, entails employing a broader framework that includes their beliefs, intentions, goals, and history, page 428. In other words, one way agents make sense of their own actions is by appealing to their narrative self, Schechtman 1996. In this picture, narrative archetypes reflect the expectations that social institutions have regarding how individuals ought to act. Agents, from an early age, are told stories that involve fixed types of characters and learn to understand their actions based on their identification with these characters. Crucially, while Brancaccio highlights the strongly gendered aspect of these archetypes, e.g. the caring mother, M, and H, mention archetypes that are common in neoliberal institutions, e.g., the hardworking employee and the innovative entrepreneur, M, and H, 2019, page 199. The idea is that the imposing of these archetypes by the hand of institutions leads agents to employ ready-made interpretive schemas to understand others and themselves. While we fully agree with M, and H, that clarifying how received archetypes that shape our embodied habits is crucial for us to realize the subtle ways in which social norms deeply affect us, we also contend that it reveals only one side of the coin. In fact, someone can wonder what agents can do to oppose the influence of narrative archetypes. A suggestion, we believe, is to be found in the fact that we ourselves are prolific narrators, and our storytelling aims go beyond making sense of ourselves and our actions. As Brancaccio herself notes, Oni can deliberate about what she ought to do and form future intentions based on the type of person she believes she is or has been, her related goals and desires, and so forth, 2019, page 429. While being uncontroversial, this statement directs us to the main subject of the present commentary. We do not merely understand ourselves in light of imposed narrative archetypes, but we also engage in narrative practices. The notion of narrative practices, which we employ to highlight the active and productive character of self-narration, raises a question relevant to present purposes, which concerns how agents engage in narrative deliberation and intention formation. After having addressed this in the following section, we will conclude by arguing that the notion of narrative practices can be fruitfully integrated in M. and H.'s positive proposal within the mind-body politic. Section 3. Narrative practices in embodied cognition. At first sight, the fact that self-narration is productive, in the sense that we have the ability to spin new narratives about ourselves, can be considered trivial and not particularly interesting in itself. Instead, the argument that we bring forward here is rather based on the idea that the way in which we narrate ourselves importantly shapes our embodied relationship with the world. Brandon 2016, Jongpire 2016, Koster 2017. Narrative practices, we contend, are productive also in the sense that they bring about concrete changes in one's embodiment and behavior. This is the central tenet of narrative therapy, as illustrated by McConnell and Snook 2018. Through self-narration, agents can engage in self-governance. This is possible through building narrative connections between their plans, desires, and contingent circumstances in order to work out which actions make sense given the circumstances, page 32. With this idea in mind, the first issue that needs addressing is how self-narration affects our embodied relation to the world. Reflecting about narrative therapy, Hutto, Brancaccio, and Aaborg, 2017, note that the exercise of narrative practices can affect our engagement with the world and others by making a fundamental difference to what we see the world is offering us as well as our potential to respond to such offerings, page 301. Self-narratives are stories, and as such they are selective. They are comprised of a more or less coherent set of values, beliefs, goals, and past events that we refer to when in need of understanding ourselves and our surroundings and to deliberate about the future. Intuitively, narratives that are forward-looking, as opposed to backward-looking narratives that are often used to make sense of our past, do not include an infinite set of possible options and goals, but only the ones that are relevant to who we understand ourselves to be. It is clear, therefore, how engaging narrative thinking can open our perception to new, previously hidden options. However, the question remains of how one can implement abstract goals and values resulting from narrative deliberation in concrete terms that affect behavior. In regards to this last issue, Dings, 2019, identifies a spectrum of different attentive modes that an agent can adopt towards herself. On one end, she can detach herself from her current situation and focus her attention on her narrative as a whole in order to establish goals or attribute meanings to particular events or objects. On the other end, she can reflect on her current situation, and assess whether the action she is undertaking is coherent with her self-narrative. Combining these different kinds of attentive modes, agents can engage in narrative self-programming. Page 9. Often, when we deliberate about ourselves, e.g., about the persons we want to be and what goals we care to reach, we do so in abstract terms, and this leads to difficulties in implementing the right courses of action needed to reach them. However, through a conscious effort, we can also specify such narrative goals in more concrete subgoals and actions that we know will bring us nearer to our aims. This activity, according to Dings, makes us perceive the right kind of affordances and possibilities for action that are relevant to our narrative goals and self-understanding, so that we respond to them in desired ways. Also refer to Brancaccio and Segundo Orton 2020. For example, the abstract goal of being a healthy person can be implemented through the more concrete plan of going for a walk after breakfast every day. In other words, by forming such plans, agents can program their responsiveness in accordance with their self-narratives, i.e., they can determine to which affordances they should be responsive to. Another example of this narrative self-programming is narrative meaning-making. This is employed when we need to give meaning to an impactful event in our lives. Since part of this process also entails deliberating about what specific actions will be relevant in which specific contexts, Dings concludes that narrative endeavors are best understood as efforts to influence or alter those embodied interactions. 2019, page 10. For present purposes, another aspect of the productivity of narratives needs to be highlighted. It is not simply the case that the production of new narratives can change our embodied responsiveness in the future. Rather, it is often the case that new narratives alter existing ones. Self-narratives are fluid and in constant change, much of the time below our own awareness. However, it is also possible that agents find themselves in the need to re-elaborate their life stories actively and consciously. This is the case, for example, when the presence of inconsistencies can lead an individual to adjust her narrative and, as a consequence, her behavior. In this regard, McConnell and Snook, 2018, offer a valuable illustration of the importance of narrative practices to the process of recovering from addictions, where patients are usually struggling to enact a narrative that is in line with their values against an established self-narrative that depicts addiction as inescapable. It is in this context that the practice of reauthoring one's narrative becomes essential. Becoming narratively skilled by also learning how to enrich one's self-narrative and reinterpreting one's history is a way to perceive the relevant affordances and possibilities for action that did not seem available before. Hutto, Brancaccio, and Aubourg, 2017. Thus, narrative practices can be both backward and forward-looking. On one hand, the individual must be able to reinterpret previous beliefs, events, and so on. On the other, she must attempt to put in place narrative connections between her current self-narrative and the one she aims for. McConnell and Snook, 2018, page 34. Our claim, however, is that putting in place new narratives is not just an intellectual endeavor. Rather, it has profound consequences for how we experience the world in embodied terms. As such, actively engaging in narrative practices can bring positive consequences and can help us fight and revert the harmful influences exerted by neoliberal institutions, helping us to create social institutions that instead promote mentally healthy, authentic, and fulfilling lives. We dedicate the following section to flesh out this positive proposal. Section 4. Narrative practices and constructive, enabling institutions. Given that we are inevitably shaped by the social institutions we live in, M.N.H. argue that our efforts should converge into building institutions that enable individuals to freely express themselves and their agency. Such institutions, built on participatory decision-making, would promote critical consciousness and dialogical free inquiry, and would also allow for the development of flexible habits of the mind by breaking from tradition and allowing for collaboration. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 228-235. The questions they turn to answer is thus how to build such institutions and, most importantly, how the right changes in an individual's effective framing can take place. In this final section, we show how narrative practices can be a promising addition to their proposal. M.N.H. claim that to alter the problematic frames of reference resulting from living in neoliberal capitalist institutions, individuals should engage in inactive transformative learning, which targets the subject's embodied and active meaning-making, Mays 2017. Although they acknowledge that the relevant change must be both cognitive and effective, M. H. Emphasize how conceptual learning itself might not be a successful avenue. Besides new tools of thoughts, they hold agents have to form new patterns of attention and modes of feeling. It follows that enabling institutions should bring about positive change by targeting subjects' bodily comportment, feelings, desires, and emotions. In other words, NEW concepts and thoughts can be emancipatory, but agents need to be transformed in terms about what they, as essentially embodied minds, really care about. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 269. We are deeply sympathetic with them. NHS proposal. However, we believe that conceptual thinking and deliberation can play a bigger role in the picture. According to them, humans' effective framing is often essentially non-conceptual and non-deliberative, while involving, first and foremost, bodily engagement and attunement, Hannah 2015, Mays 2011. Moreover, they claim that much of our meaning-making is underdetermined by conceptual, propositional, and inferential framing. Case in point are the different kinds of pedagogies that they suggest as ways to engage in enactive transformative learning. Examples include learning-centered pedagogy, Concepcion and Elfin 2009, and activist pedagogy, Preston and Aslett 2014, which focus the subjects actually performing relevant activities, e.g. organizing campaigns, in order to experience what is to be learned, rather than just receiving information or different forms of creative expression, ranging from dancing, music, gardening, and drama, which are apt to disrupt frames of references by provoking inquiry and innovation or facilitating the sharing of experiences among individuals, Mays and Hannah 2019, page 278-283. Importantly, we do not wish to underestimate the importance of these activities, but rather to complement them by also adding room for reflective and deliberative endeavors. Given the tight connection between embodiment, effective framing, and self-narrative that we previously illustrated, we believe that narrative practices are an additional tool that can change individuals' effective framing in positive ways. Following McGeer, 2019, we note that the cultural practices we are immersed in give us cognitive resources that we can employ to question and change the practices themselves. Moreover, heterodox practices, i.e. practices that somewhat stand in opposition to the mainstream ones, importantly depend on the development of new epistemic tools, ranging from new forms of interpretation and sense-making and new systems of evaluation, page 54. To give a more concrete example, let us first note that building self-narratives is a collective endeavor, as shown, e.g., by the phenomenon of narrative archetypes. Moreover, throughout our adult lives, how others interact with us deeply shape our self-understanding. Thus, narrative practices directed to ourselves also importantly depend on others accepting and enacting the new narrative content, McConnell and Snook, 2018. Usually, content is accepted depending on rules of coherence, both regarding our narrative whole, but also, crucially, regarding others' values. Think about what values must be in place for someone to accept a man's self-narrative of being a stay-at-home father. Furthermore, whether others comprehend and accept our self-narratives affects their behavior towards us, e.g., how they address us or what courses of action they allow us to enact. Narrative practices, we believe, entail engaging in what we call narrative bargains. New narrative content must be tested by presenting it to others, and when rejected, it can be reworked in order to submit it to a new test. Given our analysis so far, there is good reason to believe that this process will also importantly affect other self-narratives and narrative practices, and thus their values and meaning-making. Thus, we claim, a collective effort in reflection and deliberation, by also taking a narrative form in the way here presented, can bring forward important changes not only into our thinking, but also into our embodiment and effective framing. We take this to show the importance that conceptual deliberation and reflection have not only in social change, but also in changing our effective framing itself. Moreover, we have shown how our narrative self-understanding, which is deliberative in nature, is tightly woven with our embodiment. Thus, we conclude, narrative practices are an important tool to bridge epistemic and conceptual deliberation reflection and our effective, embodied lives.
Article 6, Heteronomy, Repression, and Collective Wisdom by Joseph Schieber. Famously, one of the most controversial notions in Herbert Marcuse's 2013, one-dimensional man is a distinction between true and false needs. In this commentary, I will suggest that Marcuse's distinction is ambiguous between two readings, which I term the repression reading and the heteronomy reading, respectively. I argue that considerations from Mays and Hanna's 2019 Notion of the Mind Shaping Thesis can help to see why we ought to reject the heteronomy reading in favor of the repression reading of false needs. I then suggest that the repression reading of false needs can, in turn, reveal some weaknesses in Mays and Hanna's theory of collectively wise social institutions. Section 1. Marcuse on False Needs. Marcuse explains the notion of false needs in the following passage. Quote, "False are those which are superimposed upon the individual by particular social interests in his repression, the needs which perpetuate toil, aggressiveness, misery, and injustice. Such needs have a societal content and function, which are determined by external powers over which the individual has no control. The development and satisfaction of these needs is heteronomous. No matter how much such needs may have become the individual's own, reproduced and fortified by the conditions of his existence, no matter how much he identifies himself with them and finds himself in their satisfaction, they continue to be what they were from the beginning, products of a society whose dominant interest demands repression." End quote. Marcuse, 2013, page 7. One of the difficulties with the passage is that Marcuse seems to be defining false needs in at least two different ways. The first of those ways is evident in the first sentence of the passage. Marcuse there suggests that false needs are those which perpetuate toil, aggressiveness, misery, and injustice. I'll call this the repression reading of false needs. The second of those ways, although perhaps also just barely evident in the first sentence of the passage, is dominant in the second quoted sentence. Marcuse there characterizes false needs as those that are determined by external powers over which the individual has no control. The development and satisfaction of those needs is heteronomous. I'll call this the heteronomy reading of false needs. Section 2. The heteronomy reading and the dilemma of false needs. Because Marcuse is at least partially in the grip of the heteronomy reading of false needs, he sees the very phenomenon of false needs as involving a tragic dilemma. Here's how Marcuse himself puts the problem. In the last analysis, the question of what are true and false needs must be answered by the individuals themselves, but only in the last analysis, that is, if and when they are free to give their own answer. As long as they are kept incapable of being autonomous, as long as they are indoctrinated and manipulated, down to their very instincts, their answer to this question cannot be taken as their own. By the same token, however, no tribunal can justly arrogate to itself the right to decide which needs should be developed and satisfied. Any such tribunal is reprehensible. Although our revulsion does not do away with the question, how can the people who have been the object of effective and productive domination by themselves create the conditions of freedom? Marcuse, 2013, page 8-9. The dilemma, in other words, is this. If individuals are indoctrinated and manipulated, down to their very instincts, then they cannot answer the question of what are the true and false needs. However, only the individuals themselves are capable of answering the question of what are the true and false needs. Given, however, that Marcuse sees individuals in contemporary society as indoctrinated and manipulated, it would seem impossible for those individuals to distinguish between true and false needs. This is the point of the despairing rhetorical question with which Marcuse ends the passage. How can the people who have been the object of effective and productive domination by themselves create the conditions of freedom? Section 3. Mays and Hanna contra the heteronomy reading. Luckily, however, the heteronomy reading, at least as Marcuse himself conceives of it, is false. The problem with that reading is that it presupposes a notion of autonomy that is at odds with the essentially social nature of human persons. That is, the heteronomy reading contradicts the thesis of the centrality of social institutions in shaping the minds of the individuals who make up those institutions. Mays and Hanna term the thesis that social institutions shape minds the mind-shaping thesis. Mind-shaping thesis, MST. Our minds are partially determined and shaped by the social institutions we belong to, participate in, or fall under the jurisdiction of. Mays and Hanna, 2019, page 37. Emphasis in the original. If the MST is true, however, this requires us to revise our conception of autonomy. As Mays and Hannah put it, the MST forces us to acknowledge that autonomy is always, at least in part, relationally and socially determined. It's to transcend a conception of autonomy that focuses exclusively on the individual, and also to focus one's attention on the necessary and mind-shaping role of social institutions in autonomous agency. Page 70, C.F. Schieber, 2019. Indeed, Marcuse himself seems to recognize that the only solution to the dilemma that he formulates is to abandon the requirement of robust autonomy. As Marcuse puts the point, quote, society must first enable its slaves to learn and see and think before they know what is going on and what they themselves can do to change it. And to the degree to which the slaves have been preconditioned to exist as slaves and be content in that role, their liberation necessarily appears to come from without and from above. They must be forced to be free, to see objects as they are, and sometimes as they ought to appear, they must be shown the good road they are in search of. End quote. Marcuse, 2013, page 43 to 44. What this suggests is that Marcuse anticipates that freedom might well require, even if we don't wish to characterize it as indoctrination or manipulation, the very least the imposition of new ways to see objects as they are and a reshaping of people's ways of thinking, yes, down to their very instincts. Mays and Hannah seem to have a similar process of reshaping ways of thinking in mind when they write that the social and cultural context that we inhabit socializes us and instills within us the community's intelligence and wisdom, as well as its norms and attitudes. By way of education of attention, members of society learn how to notice and engage effectively with relevant affordances and develop a feel for the game that makes it unnecessary for them to rely on explicit rules to tell them what to do. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 71. Section 4. Prospects for a revised heteronomy reading. In the previous section, I suggested that the plausibility of Mays and Hannah's mind-shaping thesis tells against the heteronomy reading of Marcuse's notion of false needs. Before turning to a discussion of the other alternative, the repression reading, it would be worthwhile to address the prospects for a revised version of the heteronomy reading. What I have in mind is this. Although Mays and Hannah reject notions of autonomy incompatible with the mind-shaping thesis, they do not thereby abandon the notion of autonomy, and by extension, heteronomy, altogether. Rather, they suggest that, while autonomous persons are not independent of social forces, they are also able, at least in principle, to reflect on them critically, examine how these forces shape their values, desires, and attitudes, and endorse some influences while rejecting and resisting others. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 70. Might this revised notion of autonomy underwrite a correspondingly revised notion of heteronomy capable of underwriting a revised heteronomy reading of the notion of false needs? I am less optimistic about the prospects for resting the hopes for a revised notion of autonomy on the ability, at least in principle, of persons to reflect critically on social forces and to examine how these forces shape their values, desires, and attitudes, and endorse some influences while rejecting and resisting others. There are three reasons for my pessimism. The first is that persons are often ill-equipped adequately to identify the social forces that shape their values, desires, and attitudes. Recall that Mays and Hannah suggest that our social and cultural context socializes us and instills within us the community's intelligence and wisdom, as well as its norms and attitudes. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 117. Such socialization and the inculcation of norms and attitudes often remain unobserved and unquestioned by the participants in those social and cultural contexts. Mays and Hannah seem to suggest that the autonomous agent would behave in contrast to Mill's 19th-century gentlemen who behave according to custom. I do not mean that they choose what is customary in preference to what suits their own inclination. It does not occur to them to have any inclination except for what is customary. Mill, quoted in Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 297 to 298. This, however, doesn't seem quite right. Mays and Hannah themselves, as quoted above, endorse the idea that by way of education of attention, members of society learn how to notice and engage effectively with relevant affordances and develop a feel for the game that makes it unnecessary for them to rely on explicit rules to tell them what to do. This, however, is not relevantly different from the notion of custom, although, of course, the relevant affordances would presumably direct the members of collectively wise societies toward better ends than those to which custom directed the 19th century gentleman of Mill's quote. So, the first reason for pessimism about a revised notion of autonomy is that persons are often ill-equipped adequately to identify the social forces that shape their values, desires, and attitudes. The second reason for pessimism is that even if people were able to identify those forces, there is little reason for thinking that they would be qualified to examine how these forces shape their values, desires, and attitudes. This is because such forces and the interactions among such forces and the values, desires, and attitudes shaped by them are unimaginably complex. Consider, for example, that Mays and Hannah endorse the idea that relationships among the component parts of social institutions could better be understood via an appeal to dynamical systems theory. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 274, citing the work of Protivi, 2009. Notoriously, the phenomena investigated by dynamical systems theory are complex and difficult to predict. Expecting individuals who are not sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists, or complexity theorists to be capable of examining those forces and their effects seems overly ambitious. Finally, the third reason for skepticism about the prospects for a revised notion of autonomy involves the implausibility of expecting individuals to endorse some influences while rejecting and resisting others. Recall Marcuse's suggestion that liberation necessarily appears to come from without and from above, and that individuals must be shown the good road they are in search of. If this is correct, then an individual's endorsement of the good road is not evidence of autonomy. Rather, it is evidence that a new paradigm has successfully replaced the old one. Section 5. The promise of the repression reading of false needs. Given the untenability of the heteronomy reading, let us turn to the repression reading of the notion of false needs. According to the repression reading, false needs are those which perpetuate toil, aggressiveness, misery, and injustice. Marcuse doesn't abandon the idea that false needs are the products of particular social interests, but in the repression reading, the salient feature is the aims to which those social interests are directed, namely, that false needs are products of a society whose dominant interest demands repression. The repression reading has a number of important implications, but I'll focus on three. First, if the repression reading is correct, then, contra Marcuse himself, the notion of false needs does not give rise to the dilemma that plagued the heteronomy reading of false needs. This is because on the repression reading, it is not incompatible with true needs that they be recognized only as a result of liberation from without and above. On the repression reading, what makes a need false is not that it has a societal content and function which are determined by external powers over which the individual has no control. Rather, it's that its content is directed toward the perpetuation of toil, aggression, misery, and injustice. A second important implication of the repression reading is that the status of some goal as satisfying a basic human need, such as adequate nourishment or adequate accommodation, C.F. Mays and Hannah, 2019-99, might not be sufficient thereby to ensure that the goal does not involve a false need, C.F. Cutts, 2019. Suppose, for example, that I live in a society in which the only adequate housing that I can obtain is constructed out of environmentally harmful materials and under unfair labor conditions. In such a case, then even the attempt to meet my need for shelter would be deformed by the societal conditions in which I live. Marcuse seems to anticipate this point when he notes that, in the case of false needs, their satisfaction might be most gratifying to the individual. But this happiness is not a condition which has to be maintained and protected if it serves to arrest the development of the ability, his own and others, to recognize the disease of the whole and grasp the chances of curing the disease. Marcuse, 2013, page 7. Perhaps the most significant implication is that, on the repression reading, An individual's endorsement of a goal, self-identification with a goal, or gratification or happiness at achieving a goal is not good evidence for that goal's status as a true need. As Marcuse puts it, false needs remain false needs, no matter how much such needs may have become the individual's own, reproduced and fortified by the conditions of his existence. No matter how much he identifies himself with them and finds himself in their satisfaction. Section 6. Marcuse's repression reading contra Mays and Hannah. I concluded the previous section with the observation that an individual's endorsement of a goal, self-identification with a goal, or gratification or happiness at achieving a goal is not good evidence for that goal's status as a true need. In this section, I want to suggest that this implication of the repression reading represents a challenge to Mays and Hannah's notion of liberatory social institutions, institutions that conform to what Mays and Hannah call the collective wisdom thesis. Mays and Hannah characterize the collective wisdom thesis as follows. Collective wisdom thesis CWT. Some social institutions, working against the grain of standard, dystopian social institutions in contemporary neoliberal nation-states, make it really possible for us to self-realize, connect with others in a mutually aiding way, liberate ourselves, and be mentally healthy, authentic, and deeply happy. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 71, emphasis in the original. Mays and Hannah depict social institutions that instantiate the CWT as the sorts of institutions toward which emancipatory political philosophy should be working. In understanding collectively wise social institutions in this way, Mays and Hannah only focus on the ways in which social institutions might impact individual minds. In the conclusion of their book, for example, they present their investigation of the collective wisdom thesis as a way to help one another to dismantle our ideological and emotional walls, overcome our cognitive crises, and liberate our imaginations and to develop new means of engaging people's emotions so that they are able to have the sorts of valuable experiences that expand their perspectives, afford the development of flexible habits of mind, and prime their effective and practical capacities so that they can freely bring about the satisfaction of their true human needs. Mays and Hannah, 2019, page 310. What these passages underscore is that Mays and Hannah's conception of the goods to be achieved by collectively wise social institutions is mentalistic. There is evidence for this in the characterization of CWT itself. In the suggestion that the measure of a cognitively wise institution is that it allows us to be mentally healthy, authentic, and deeply happy. There is further evidence in the concluding summary of the goals of pursuing cognitively wise institutions. These goals may be divided almost entirely into three categories, all of which are mentalistic. Cognitive goals, dismantling ideological walls, overcoming cognitive crises, liberating imagination, developing flexible habits of mind. Emotional goals, dismantling emotional walls, engaging emotions, priming effective capacities. Experiential goals, having valuable experiences. By formulating the criteria for collectively wise institutions in terms of mentalistic criteria, however, Mays and Hannah run afoul of the third implication of the repression reading of the notion of false needs. For, as Marcuse points out, it is possible for an institution to become the individual's own, reproduced and fortified by the conditions of his existence, and to be such that he identifies himself with it. Marcuse, 2013, page 7. And for that institution, nevertheless, to involve a false need. In defense of Mays and Hannah, one might respond that the specific sorts of mentalistic criteria associated by them with collectively wise institutions are nevertheless incompatible with false needs. There are at least two reasons why such a response is unpromising. The first reason is that it is possible to imagine the existence of an institution satisfying all of the conditions that Mays and Hannah delineate, but whose existence depends on the prevalence of widespread unjust conditions outside of the real-world utopia of the institution itself. For example, on the model of Hannah Arendt's conception of the Athenian city-state, Arendt, 2013, page 50, We could imagine a society in which those within the privileged class enjoy all of the cognitive, emotional, and experiential achievements that Mays and Hanna associate with collectively wise institutions, but in which the existence of the privileged class itself depends on the existence of a slave class. While such an institution would seemingly satisfy Mays and Hanna's definition of a collectively wise institution, it would run afoul of Marcuse's requirement that an institution must be rejected if it serves to arrest the development of the ability to recognize the disease of the whole and grasp the chances of curing the disease. The second reason is that Mays and Hanna endorsed the solidarity thesis. Solidarity thesis ST. A social institution instantiates CWIFF, it manifests robust solidarity via social production. Page 73, emphasis in the original. On Mays and Hanna's view, a social institution involves solidarity only if I, members of an institution, share joint executive interests. Two, there is, at least implicitly, a reciprocal identification with and recognition from the group. Page 72. Three, there is a shared disposition to empathy. Four, conditions I-3 give rise to a goal-specific trust among members of the institution. Mays and Hanna, 2019. Page 72, emphases in the original. Note, however, that it is possible both for an institution to manifest robust solidarity and for that institution to consist of individuals suffering from what Mays and Hanna term cognitive walls, i.e., effective screen S against manifest reality and truth, I. Walls concerning their sense of individual identity as a person. Two, walls concerning their sense of group identity as card-carrying member of some important social community or institution. Page 300, emphases in the original. To take one example, many of the insurrectionists of January 6, 2021, I shared a joint executive interest. Two, identified reciprocally with and were recognized by the group. Three, displayed a shared disposition to empathy with members of the group and thereby, four, exhibited goal-specific trust with other members of the group. If this is correct, however, then Mays and Hanna would seem contra reality to be forced to characterize the insurrectionists of January 6, 2021 as a collectively wise institution. Again, Marcuse's repression reading would avoid such an unpalatable consequence. Article 7. The Mind and the Political, by Ali Taimouri. The philosophy of mind has traditionally engaged with issues related to individual minds in isolation by focusing on issues such as mental function, representations, the problem of consciousness, and the mind-body relation. The recent interdisciplinary research of Fort Ecognition has stretched the boundaries of philosophical works on the mind, exploring the dynamics of the interactions between the mind, body, and the physical and social environment. Mays and Hanna's 2019 work, The Mind-Body Politic, sets a new ambition for philosophy of mind to develop a new critical and political philosophy of mind. They do engage with the classical problems of philosophy of mind, such as Cartesian mind-body dualism, and they use their own account of essentially embodied minds in response to mind-body dualism. Most remarkably, though, they extend the essentially embodied mind thesis to develop a critique of contemporary social institutions, and as a result, to change them for the better, too. Extending the essentially embodied mind's thesis, they investigate a wide range of topics, such as habit formation, mental health, and education. In the process, they analyze the influence of neoliberal institutions on the mind and how it is possible to develop new and constructive social institutions. This is indeed a very timely and highly needed work to extend the literature of embodied cognition to social and political life. I am very sympathetic to Mays and Hanna's project to develop a political philosophy of mind. Mays and Hanna argue that the current neoliberalism's ever-increasing assault on normative social institutions has resulted in destructive, deforming institutions, which in turn foster bad habits and mind-shaping expectations and activities that are driven by false human needs. It is also extremely informative that they show how the insight from embodied cognition, effective processes, and political philosophy can help us envisage and organize new social institutions that are productive and serve to improve human conditions. Having said that, I have some reservations and open questions about the way Mays and Hanna lay out their project. In this commentary, I present a very brief account of May's and Hannah's political philosophy of mind and present my own questions and critique regarding the general outline of their project. I focus on three main shortcomings. 1. Their dualistic view of the way society is organized and works. Page 2. The confusion in some of their conceptual frameworks and their account of politics. And finally, 3. Their analysis of the social institutions, especially the way they envision how new institutional structures can be formed. Section 1. The problem of duality. Mays and Hannah criticize the Cartesian mind-body duality and present their account of the essentially embodied mind with three main theses. The first thesis is a mind-shaping thesis according to which social institutions, such as family and the education system, constantly and saliently determine, restrain, and reframe our embodied mind. Second, they argue that most neoliberal social institutions shape our minds in a detrimental way that would alienate us and enslave our minds, hence their collective sociopathy thesis. The third and final thesis is a collective wisdom thesis, in which they argue that through a few institutions or by creation of new constructive institutions, people can strive for self-realization, liberate themselves from dystopian neoliberal social institutions, and achieve a deeply happy life. Mays and Hannah present a persuasive account of embodied mind to overcome Descartes' mind-body dualism, but they retain an essentially dualistic thinking about the way in which society works, structuring their argument dualistically with destructive versus constructive institutions, false versus true needs, bad versus good habits, false versus true freedom, coercion versus autonomy, false versus true consciousness, and so on. For instance, the authors categorize the need as I, true human needs, and 2, false human needs, 98, emphases and original. This also results in a simplistic account of the way in which society works and goes through changes. Constructive, enabling institutions can be generated simply by negating each criterion in the list of working criteria for destructive slash deforming institutions in contemporary neoliberal democratic societies, and then reformulating each negated criterion in positive terms. Page 227, my emphasis. This presents a simple dualistic view of society, opposing the current dystopian world with their own vision of a utopian society. That is not to say that I do not agree with their characterization of the destructive effects of the neoliberal assault on the global population and our normative institutions, and in particular its destructive effect on people's lives and minds. Things are even worse than neoliberalism in many parts of the world, such that there is a radical neoliberalism for the poor, but a radical protectionism and socialism for the rich, also known as the bailout economy. Nor do I deny the need for new and constructive institutions to organize things differently. However, I would argue that there is not a clear-cut dualism of good and evil. In addition, I found it problematic to try to impose a vision of utopia on society as a whole. The authors have a universalistic idea of what a good society would look like, claiming that it is normatively a better world to live in for everyone. They assume that they have a universal vision of a utopian society in which everyone gets a satisfaction of their true needs and exercises their true freedom. They derive the legitimacy of their vision of society from normative principles, which are beyond the potential reservations of those who might find themselves subject to it. Instead of imposing externally justified standards to analyze the present, a more constructive approach to deal with our current predicament is to expose how the existing institutional frameworks and social reality fail to live up to their own normative claims. That is, by using an immanent critique. In doing so, one can expose the limits of the current political conditions and leave open possibilities that are available to society to organize itself differently. One of the pioneers of immanent critique was indeed Karl Marx, 1976, when he moved away from his earlier humanist and utopian vision to study capital from a scientific vantage point. He showed the irrationality of the rational discourse of political economy and the capitalist mode of production. He did so by focusing on classical political economy's contradictions, as well as the lived experiences of the working class of industrial capitalism in the 18th and 19th centuries. In contrast, Mays and Hannah expressed their explicit intention to rely on earlier marks for their design of a new humanistic and utopian society, which led to their dualistic vision of society. It seems to me that it was the limits of that dualistic way of viewing society that led Marx to his later use of immanent critique. Section 2. The Political Structure. The inherently dualistic thinking in Mays and Hannah's work brings up the second shortcoming of the book, their problematic account of politics. According to Mays and Hannah, neoliberalism creeps into our everyday life and breeds false needs and false freedom of choices. They claim that the neoliberal ideology coalesces with a scientific worldview aiming at controlling society, and such a neoliberal ideology can lead to coercive authoritarianism, causing collective sociopathy. There are several problematic issues in the conceptual framework of political structure in the mind-body politic. First, there is a confusion in the definition of neoliberalism. They laid down their account of neoliberalism at the beginning of the book as a political doctrine encompassing classical Hobbesian liberalism with a conception of individuals as egoists seeking their own self-interested goals, big capitalism with its multinational and global corporate structure, and scientifically-minded technocracy, pages 3 to 4 and 103. Later, they rely on a different definition of neoliberalism as a policy framework, an ideology, and a form of governmentality, page 125. Do these three parts form a definition of neoliberalism as a political doctrine? That seems to be the case since they sporadically refer to David Harvey's account as well, who treats neoliberalism as a hegemonic political project. How is neoliberalism as a form of governmentality related to neoliberalism as an ideology? It seems that they consider centrism, conservatism, and other narratives as loosely formulated dominant ideological narratives that justify neoliberal forms of governmentality. That is at least my understanding of their political analysis, and clarification is required to see if that is a correct reading. In my view, some caution is warranted in integrating such different approaches. For instance, combining ideology and governmentality needs proper justification and clarification. Mays and Hannah present various accounts of ideology, such as an epistemological philosophical account in terms of false consciousness, e.g., Tommy Shelby's account of ideology as misrepresentation of reality, and hidden injustice, page 260, the political meaning of ideology as ideas of ruling class, Larner's definition of neoliberalism as ideology, page 126, and also ideology as a system of beliefs, values, and social imagination, referring to Sally Haslinger's idea of deep schema, page 262. Given their distinction between destructive and constructive institutions, and also between false and true needs, they take the task of ideology critique to be uncovering the underlying truth that the dominant narrative or social imagination attempts to hide. They also talk about changing people's conceptual frames of reference for a critical understanding of reality, pages 263. In contrast, there is no distinction in the governmentality account between what goes on at the surface and what is the underlying truth. Instead, in Foucault's account of governmentality, everything is on the surface and in the way in which particular practices or modes of subjectivity are related to relations of power and rationalities of government. My impression is that Foucault's 2008 Governmentality can shed light on the main problems associated with neoliberal capitalist system, such that a body of knowledge is produced, e.g., human capital, effective demand, freedom, competition, behavioral economics, in particular relations of power, e.g., political interests, a reform of administrative and legal system, reformed labor market, with major truth effects for the formation of individual subjectivity, e.g. their needs, desires, ideals, hard and soft skills, and expectations. It is precisely this neoliberal form of subjectivity that seems problematic for Mays and Hannah, though their explanations get a bit more confusing when they also try to explain neoliberalism from a variety of other perspectives. Mays and Hannah showed the destructive effect of neoliberalism on individual minds through two case studies, including the mental health and education system. These examples are very illuminating and instructive, though still some of the confusion in conceptual frameworks persist. For instance, the authors use Foucault's concept of governmentality to explain individuals' understanding of themselves through mental health practices. At the same time, they use the concept of ideology to explain widespread mental health practices. More precisely, in explaining their account of mental health, they oppose the value-free and naturalistic account of psychiatry, claiming that the ideology of mental health is a socially constructed myth, page 176. Then they consider how the medical model of psychiatry is part of the larger ideological framework of what they call socioscientism, page 180. How governmentality is related to ideological practices is not at all clear, nor is the relation between ideology and socioscientism. Does it mean that when someone is seeking a professional mental health service, they are buying into the ideology of hegemonic neoliberal ideals? I doubt that Mays and Hanna would agree with such a generalization, and it seems to me what they mean is that the knowledge from scientific mental health practices and psychiatry serve different human interests and might not be in line with social emancipatory ideals, as one might derive from Habermas, 1987, Knowledge and Human Interests. At least, that is my impression. Finally, Mays and Hanna list 8 criteria of collective sociopathy, including commodification, mechanization, coercion, divided mind, reversal of effect, loss of autonomy, incentivization of desires, and false consciousness. They do not provide sufficient reasons why one has to consider these 8 criteria to examine social phenomena and institutions, and to see whether they are normal or whether they fulfill the criteria for sociopathy. It seems to me that they rely on later Marx to elucidate the way in which a particular technological infrastructure and mode of production, consumption, and circulation reproduce a particular mode of daily life, mental conceptions of the world, social relations, and a relation to the nature, Marx 1976, pages 493, for a clear elucidation of Marx's methodology on this point. Harvey 2010, page 195. I see a potential for the integration of Marx's later works with Foucault's account of governmentality to provide insight into our predicaments and to present a scientifically rigorous account of a detrimental effect of the hegemonic neoliberal mode of subjectivity and models of social institutions in our time. Although there are traces of such a successful integration in Mays and Hanna's work, it remains quite vague and fragmentary. Section 3. Social Institutions. Finally, regarding the formation of new institutions, Mays and Hanna remain at a general level and ambiguous. For instance, they characterize the new enabling constructive institutions to be those that afford the flexible mental habits of curiosity, imagination, empathy, and humility, page 236 to 237. This sounds interesting indeed, and such a social institution would be constructive. They intend to achieve the formation of new enabling social institutions through what they call reverse social engineering and through enactive transformative learning, pages 246. Later, they clarify that this transformative learning involves changing problematic frames of reference, which include habits of mind, meaning perspectives, assumptions, and expectations, pages 247, emphasis and original. As shown in the next 2 paragraphs, it is surprising that the solution and resistance to dystopian social institutions end up being able to change one's perspectives, assumptions, and expectations through new institutions. Although I found their approach to bring about new social institutions very interesting, it might need to address a few issues for its realization. First, it seems to me that their solution might turn into another individualistic account of social change. The authors focus on changing individuals' frames of reference and flexible habits of mind to bring about change and to construct new constructive social institutions. The solution seems to be basically the same for our neoliberal planners that seek to address unemployment problems through self-assertion techniques and job interview skills. Many social changes take place through collective actions and social movements, as well as political organizations that heed the cry of the grassroots movements. Changing one's perspectives and assumptions would make individuals more sympathetic toward progressive social movements, but it is not sufficient for a social change. To create new social institutions, it is also necessary to form or have an organizational and political structure to make the necessary social change. Otherwise, all of these individualistic solutions are likely to be co-opted in the cultural logic of late capitalism. Jameson, 1991, Senate 2006. This brings me to the second issue with regards to May's and Hannah's account of social change, that the intermediary process between the political and the mental remains obscure. That is, the process of change from individuals' minds to social institutions is not clear. As I have just shown, some of the solutions regarding individuals' changes in their frames of reference are individualistic and might fall into the logic of late capitalism. How can one be sure that the change in frames of references and flexible habits of mind would be in the service of the emancipatory ideals? Are these solutions not already widespread through self-help books? Mays and Hannah do emphasize that the change in frame of references should occur through the constructive enabling of social institutions and transformative learning. This means that the popular self-help books do not qualify for bringing about transformative learning. Moreover, there are also sometimes references indicating that an institutional change is necessary for a flexible habit of mind and creative thinking, i.e., a top-down process of change through transformative learning. Though still, the process of change from individuals' frames of reference to social institutions and vice versa can perhaps be better illuminated. It is also a bit surprising that the solution Mays and Hannah offer based on emancipatory social and political theories is just a learning process. Quite ironically, the neoliberals would love the solution. It is in line with their own solutions as well. Empowerment, self-help, and more therapeutic and counseling services. Mays and Hannah set themselves against the neoliberal models of society, but the solution they provide for the creation of new institutions is in line with the therapeutic culture of our neoliberal era, C.F. Madsen, 2020. Perhaps a durable and transformative change in mental habits and frames of references requires a more fundamental change in society, such as a change in technical infrastructure, labor market, and its mode of production and reproduction, as later Marx would have it. But that topic is beyond the purpose of the current discussion. Section 4. Concluding Remarks. The mind-body politic starts with a thesis for a political philosophy of mind. Mays and Hannah's main aim is to demonstrate the destructive and deformative effect of neoliberal political economy on people's essentially embodied minds and advocate building new social institutions that would improve people's embodied minds according to certain normative and emancipatory principles. There are several main shortcomings that significantly undermine Mays and Hannah's account of mind-body politics. These include their dualistic and Manichaean view of society, their unclear account of politics, and their individualistic and therapeutic solutions to our current predicaments. Their social and political account did not consider the nuances and complexities across different social and political theories, and sometimes various concepts were used in a convoluted way. It would have been helpful to keep distinct concepts apart, or at least clarify the nuances that exist between various theories and concepts. For instance, neoliberalism is not the same as neoconservatism and centrism, although their interests might coalesce at times. Governmentality is not the same as ideology, though they might sometimes study the same object. On a minor, but no less important point, the author's writing seems more like a manifesto than a philosophical argument. I take that to be a wake-up call for a critical and political philosophy of mind. In addition, the authors provide a long list of books and perspectives that have inspired their approach, which I found impressive, page 7 in passim, and their references to others read more like an alliance formation we agree / disagree with, than a critical engagement. I take that to be part of the goal of their work and a task for us to consider the broader political implications of our scientific and philosophical works. Habermas' knowledge in human interests is quite illuminating for this point. Finally, Mays and Hannah's version of resisting the destructive social institutions fits somehow ironically with the culture of late capitalism, being individualistic and consistent with the widespread dominant therapeutic culture and empowerment literature. Perhaps that is a sign of the difficulty of the task for bringing social change that lies ahead of us. The aim of the mind-body politic to develop a political philosophy of mind is quite ambitious, and several questions still remain open. We must still ask how one can apply the insight from embodied minds to analyze our current socio-political conditions, and what are the ways in which such insights from embodied minds can help us develop more constructive social institutions. I do think the project that Mays and Hannah set up is worth pursuing, and they already provide many hints and directions for its productive and constructive pursuit.
Article 8, Embodied Cognition in Dark Times, by Lee Wilson. Michelle Mays and Robert Hannah's The Mind-Body Politic, 2019, ambitiously sets out to combine both the philosophy of essentially embodied minds, E.M., and emancipatory political theory, E.P.T., in order to put forth a new critique of contemporary social institutions, as well as concrete, positive proposals for radically changing both these social institutions and our essentially embodied lives, for the better, page 2. There is much to admire in the way in which M. B. T. articulates its coupling of E. E. M. and E. P. T. Thereafter detailing how neoliberalism affects the lives of people for worse, specifically in its expression in Anglo-European institutions of higher education and mental health practices. However, I argue that there remains an explanatory gap between the general normative foundations of their approach in E. E. M. and the particular critiques and the alternative presented. Specifically, E.M. normativity faces a political analog of the darkroom problem in what M.B.T. calls computational inactivism, page 29, note 10. And if this is not addressed, E.M. may well support totalitarian institutions as theorized by Hannah Arendt, which has been the general motivation for post-World War II Anglo-European political theory, cf. Verovsek 2018, and otherwise assumed to be incompatible with E. E. M. norms in M. B. T. Consequently, E. E. M. normativity would not only be insufficient but also unnecessary for E. P. T. Section 1. E. E. M. normativity and the dark room. The overall project of M. B. T. is premised on the inactive transformative principle. Quote, enacting salient or even radical changes in the structure and complex dynamics of a social institution produces corresponding salient or even radical changes in the structure and complex dynamics of the essentially embodied minds of the people belonging to, participating in, or falling under the jurisdiction of, that institution, thereby fundamentally affecting their lives, for worse or better. End quote. Page 10. That is, social institutions are problematic or well-functioning inasmuch as they affect salient or radical changes in the structure and dynamics of individuals under such institutions for worse or better, and E. E. M plus E. P. T. is meant to offer an account of such effects and changes, the relationship between the two, as well as how the lives of such individuals are therewith worse or better. That is the E. P. T. critique of neoliberalism set out in M. B. T is meant to be grounded in E. E. M. norms on the basis of which such lives are determined to be worse or better. As I understand M. B. T's account of E. E. M. there are two key characteristics of the systemic processes of well-functioning organisms, in virtue of which lacks and breakdowns in such processes are intelligible. Conservation. An organic system O produced the components necessary for the continuance of those same processes, Thompson 2007, page 98, and manage its own flow of matter and energy so that it can regulate and control both its own internal, self-constructive processes, as well as its processes of exchange with the environment, Mays and Hannah 2019, page 16-17. Adaptivity. O's regulation of its processes of exchange with the environment are sufficiently responsive to the latter, such that conservation admits of graded notions such as lacks and breakdowns, Di Paolo 2005, page 439, where O regulates its environmental engagement so as to best serve its needs, Mays and Hannah 2019, page 17. Along with inactivists such as Evan Thompson and Ezekiel Di Paolo, M. B. T. understands conservation and adaptivity to occur in three modes of embodied cognition: organic self-regulation, sensorimotor coupling with the world, and intersubjective interaction, Mays and Hannah 2019, page 17. Such M. B. T. analyses institutional sociopathy in terms of the lacks and breakdowns of the relevant social institutions and practices, as well as their human constituents. However, as Nathaniel Barrett points out, such normativity, even with adaptivity, is just prescriptive normativity plus fortuitous change. Barrett, 2017, page 441. That is, it aims only at the restoration of an underdetermined and therefore somewhat open form of identity, and by chance this restoration involves a restructuring that constitutes a favorable alteration of identity, page 441. There would, thus, be no internal reason for an organism or social institution that has achieved equilibrium to adapt. This lack of internal reason to undergo change presents us with a political version of the darkroom problem that famously plagues the sort of computational inactivism that centers on predictive processing and the free energy principle. Mays and Hanna, 2019, page 29, note 10. If what grounds an organism's management of its own flow of matter and energy is a certain homeostasis about its experiences, then an organism would rather remain in a highly predictable and unsurprising environment, such as a dark room, Sun and Firestone 2020. Analogously, the normativity that grounds the inactive transformative principle would on its own entail that human organisms, as well as the complex dynamics of their social institutions, would tend to equilibria that undergo radical changes only when encountering chance environmental changes, without reason in themselves to seek such changes, if equilibria is already met. One prominent response to the darkroom problem as such is the argument that phylogenetic and ontogenetic development of the interactions of embodied human organisms and their environment shapes action policies that are targeted at the minimization of surprisal, in a way that provides reason to leave the darkroom, e.g., explore the environment to minimize costly prediction error. Fabry 2020, page 700. C.F. Friston 2013. Similarly, conservation and adaptivity can be thought to provide internal reasons for human organisms and social institutions to undergo radical changes, given their respective phylogenetic and ontogenetic developments, i.e., for such organisms and institutions to achieve equilibria not otherwise present, as seen in M. B. T.'s critique of neoliberal higher education institutions and mental health practices. Yet, as Regine Fabry observes, the darkroom problem does have psychopathological expression and explanatory purchase in cases of major depressive disorder, given that depressive experiences can be associated with specific dysfunctions of the prediction error minimization mechanism, in spite of shared phylogeny and ontogeny. Fabry 2020, page 699. That is, the darkroom problem might not be necessitated by conservation and adaptivity, but it would at least be possibly supported by them under certain conditions. Similarly, in what follows, I suggest that Arendt's close phenomenological attention to totalitarian institutions and how they co-opt the aforementioned three modes of embodied cognition, organic self-regulation, sensor-motor coupling with the world and intersubjective interaction, can be similarly supported by the norms of conservation and adaptivity, such that the inactive transformative principle would be at best insufficient as the normative basis of M. B. T. P. T. critiques, if not unnecessary. Section 2. The Specter of Totalitarianism. Unlike those extreme pathological cases briefly mentioned in M. B. T., where effective framing patterns become more ingrained and a minded animal gets locked into particular modes of movement and response, major depressive disorder is often characterized precisely by an adaptivity to social environments aimed at maintaining cognitive equilibrium, i.e. conservation. Badcock et al. 2017. Similarly, following Arendt's 1958 analysis in the second edition of The Origins of Totalitarianism, totalitarian institutions and their contributory participants are also characterized by an adaptivity to political environments aimed at maintaining cognitive equilibria through the distinct operations of terror and ideology. While these are neither equivalent to conservation and adaptivity, nor necessitated by inactive normativity, inactive normativity nevertheless provides crucial normative support for them. The norm of conservation would support totalitarian institutions in the operation of terror, which involves the totalitarian state's identification of its laws with the supposed laws of an unfolding, putative history or nature, aimed at fabricating humanity as a transhistorical superorganic singularity. Unlike the authoritarianism specifically criticized in M. B. T. which stabilizes the complex dynamics of social institutions by curbing radical change with positive, coercive laws. Totalitarian terror stabilization of such dynamics is carried out by eradicating those very laws that individuate and simultaneously relate human beings as individuals to each other. While, say, authoritarian property laws may coercively limit the human organism's environment, such individuals can nevertheless retain their unique manifestations of the various modes of embodied cognition within those limits. Yet under totalitarianism, all property is at the disposal of the state. The laws of totalitarian terror function to relate individuals by de-individuating them into mere specimen, merging human plurality into a single, putative humanity. From the internal point of view of a totalitarian system, non-conforming individuals are to be removed by coercive mechanisms as disequilibrants. In this way, intersubjective interaction, which relies on the participatory sense-making of unique organisms, and whose uniqueness are precisely a function of such sense-making, would be reduced to how parts of a singular body politic relate to each other for the sake of conserving that body politic, and the regulation of the systemic processes of such specimen are thereby taken over and equilibrated by the teleological aim of producing the overarching superorganism. That is, intersubjective interaction would be phenomenologically conflated with a sensor-motor coupling with the world aimed at collectively producing artifacts of a putative humanity. Conservation is thereby normatively crucial, since the relevant regulation and control is understood as being performed by the superorganism itself. Hope for emancipatory politics is lost without the possibility of individual human organisms disclosing themselves to each other as unique sense-makers in the intersubjective mode of embodied cognition. The co-opting of intersubjective interaction prevents a who from emerging, as all relations between human beings under totalitarian conditions are mediated by the laws of a putative history or nature, reducing every human being to a mere specimen, a what, and confining sense-making between individuals to continuing the processes of producing and maintaining a putative humanity. Intersubjective interaction under non-totalitarian contexts, on the other hand, consists in an interrelational network of individuals that manifest to each other in speech and action, under which organisms act and make sense of themselves with reference to the particular demands governing the activity, which issue from the founding event wherein the sense-making network is initially formed by a plurality of individuals relating to each other on the basis of self-sense-making undetermined by sensorimotor or organic self-regulation, demands hence such organisms are obliged by freedom rather than power or persuasion. The internal stability of this intersubjective network is a result of the persistence of the materiality and organization of speech and action in the exchange of these self-presentations, maintained by feedback loops of participatory sense-making, Arendt 1998, C.F. de Jager and D. Paolo 2007. Norms that govern intersubjective interaction, e.g., the laws governing a non-totalitarian state, have their relevant normativity inasmuch as they are one, justified by the participation of their individual actors, sans coercion and persuasion within the relevant institution and practices, two, relate one back to the founding event of those institutions and practices, and three, are seen as encoding the testimony of those who witnessed, created, and subsequently augmented the founding event in Standards and Models, Arendt 1968. At the same time, adaptivity would support totalitarian institutions in the operation of ideology, the logic of an idea, which involves the totalitarian state's identification of the development of an idea with the movement of history and nature, Arendt 1976, page 469. Such a development is thought of as the consequence of the idea itself and needs no outside factor to set it into motion, being able to explain every historical and natural event as the unfolding of its own dialectic, page 469. This extremely plastic and responsive process, which is more fundamental a concern for a totalitarian state than the particular idea itself, Arianism for Nazi Germany or Bolshevism for Stalinist Russia, is achieved by the application of dialectical logic to every idea, such that each idea is transformed into a premise, page 469. This results in environmental entities always already being understood and experienced as mere resources to be utilized, or obstacles to be overcome, for ends external to them, i.e., for the ends of the totalitarian system, whenever necessary. That is, the unique sense-making of an individual human organism's sensorimotor coupling with the world, which involves the transformation of environmental entities into corollary artifacts, and whose uniqueness are a function of such sense-making, would be operating alongside terror, reduced to how such products are merely to be consumed in the superorganic self-regulation of the totalitarian system. Again, adaptivity is thereby normatively crucial for the totalitarian system's response to environmental changes and foreclosing the possibility of responses that would result in the radical restructuring of those human organisms and institutions of a totalitarian state. The co-opting of sensorimotor coupling with the world prevents the organism from developing a unique coupling with its environment, inasmuch as it extends the same necessity governing any organism's production in organic self-regulation, insensitive to its unique position in its concrete environment. Sensorimotor coupling with the world under non-totalitarian contexts, on the other hand, involves an interrelational network of transformed environmental artifacts and participants, under which human beings act and make sense of themselves with specific reference to the demands governing the activity that themselves issue from the overarching organization of such a network. The internal stability of this sensorimotor network is a result of the persistence of the materiality and organization of the environmental network, which are maintained by feedback loops between the activities of the organism and their corresponding environmental artifacts. The norms that govern such a world, i.e., the norms governing building construction, such as always ensure a firm foundation with wooden beams, then would have the relevant normativity inasmuch as they are one, justified by the demands of the particular activity, i.e., to support heavy bricks, to relate participating human organisms back to the initiation of the cooperative activity, in terms of its motivation and goal orientation, like the formation of the construction company, and 3, can be seen as standards and models that encode the initiation of the cooperative activity, even if augmented by recognized representatives of the cooperative, e.g., always ensure a firm foundation with steel beams. Each mode of embodied cognition has its own kind of norms irreducible to each other and, importantly, irreducible to the autopoietic biological ones, just as the modes are themselves irreducible to each other. The worry here, to summarize, is that grounding politics on E.M.S. norms of conservation and adaptivity phenomenologically conflates sensorimotor coupling with the world with organic self-regulation, and also, transitively, with intersubjective interaction with organic self-regulation. As Arendt would underscore, it is precisely because the normativity of the intersubjective and sensorimotor modes of embodied cognition are distinct from organic normativity that the former's norms are experienced as norms of political and practical freedoms, respectively. The totalitarian operations of terror and ideology are precisely achieved through an understanding of intersubjective interaction and sensorimotor, coupling with the world as grounded in the norms of conservation and adaptivity, such that failures of the latter two modes of cognition are mistakenly understood as failures of organic self-regulation. Given inactive normativity, there can be no internal reason for a totalitarian system, as well as those given to totalitarian modes of cognition, to change, to leave the dark room of politics, as it were. E. P. T. As such, cannot be dependent on E. E. M. Section 3. Conclusion. In the foregoing, I have argued that the E. E. M. norms presented in M. B. T. are at least insufficient, if not unnecessary, for the particular kind of E. P. T. critiques it hopes to mount against neoliberal institutions, and a fortiori for its characterizations of non-sociopathic institutions. Given that E. E. M. normativity is just prescriptive normativity plus fortuitous change, Barrett 2017, page 441, and that this can be in principle co-opted to support totalitarian institutions, a possible alternative to neoliberal disequilibria might well be a totalitarian equilibrium. Further attention to this possibility may perhaps also contribute to understanding the appeal of neo-fascist movements as recent responses to the failures of neoliberalism, the latter otherwise articulated by M. B. T. in admirable detail. The present exploration of an alternative totalitarian pathway that E. E. M. might lead us politically would be best understood as a friendly invitation for further elaboration on the normative basis of M. B. T. S. critiques of and proposed alternative to neoliberal institutions, C.F. Wilson 2021. But such an elaboration, importantly, should also account for why the philosophico-political clarion call of the inactive transformative principle should be sounded through particularly Anglo-European instruments, while purportedly resulting in characterizations for any non-sociopathic institution, Mays and Hanna 2019, page 10. Many Confucian political theorists, for example, understand the pathology of neoliberal institutions in terms of the lack of demophilic leadership, S. Kim 2020, while Confucian theorists of well-being dispute the centrality of autonomy to the well-functioning of human beings and institutions, and the realization of humanity, R. Kim 2020. That is, care should also be taken to avoid the danger of mistaking the needs of a specifically Anglo-European expression of the human organism with that of universal human needs, C.F. Allen 2016. Otherwise, this would thereby again conflate the political with the biological, and foreclose the possibility of radically changing Anglo-European institutions and practices themselves, giving us no reason to leave the dark room of Western bourgeois ideology. For, as Sylvia Winter warns, as long as you accept that man is a biological being, the bourgeoisie always wins, because this is its description, Winter 2006, page 26. This marks the end of the 2024, Volume 6, Issue 1, Summer Podcast Edition, Part 2, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please go to 2024, Volume 6, Issue 1, Summer Podcast Edition, Part 3, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, to continue listening to this issue.